Welcome to the Evolution Revolution. I am so thrilled to have you with us today. And you know that the purpose of the show is to introduce you to breakthroughs in the human potential movement that work. I know that you are committed to living a life of peace and joy and success. And so that's why you don't want to have to look to see if these things work. You want us to pretest them for you. Now, today, this is a very unique show because, you know, I usually highlight a guest who has something unique and different that doesn't have anything to do with me. But today, one of my dearest, close friends is here, Arno Jaffe, who for the last 14 years has been an immigration attorney. And he is just remarkable because he is the most compassionate and empathetic attorney you can find anywhere in the world, except for my corporate attorney in New York. I better say that, right? And Arno is just so wonderful because he gives his clients the kind of care and support which is based on true respect and true understanding. And he does this in English and in Spanish, which is really a spectacular benefit as well. Now, the reason that we're doing the show on Arno today and having him as a guest is that many years ago, and Arno will tell you exactly how long ago it was, we accomplished something remarkable together. When I met Arno, I asked him if he had any children. It seemed that he would be a guy who would have children, and he said yes, he had two sons at the time. One was, I think, in graduate school at the University of Arizona, Tucson, and he described the other son as being a homeless person living in San Francisco. And very quietly, my mind went crazy. Because I knew that the way he was saying this, it was just as painful for him to say it and live it as it was for me to hear it. And so I immediately said to him, would you be interested in learning how to transform that situation? And of course, you'll hear today how we did that, you know, how we accomplished this hand in hand together. And I never met his son until way on at the, you know, the process where his wonderful, beautiful, sweet, lovely son was already clean and sober. I never met him, you know, until then. Now, you know, some addicts can just be motivated to go to detox and rehab, and a 12-step program is enough for them. And for some, it isn't enough, and they need something additional. So what we're talking about today is when hope and 12 steps are not enough. You know, we wish that it would be enough for everybody just to wake up one morning and decide that they're going to get clean and sober and do it. And a lot of people can. But I want to make it so clear to you that when someone calls me, it's because the 12-step program hasn't been sufficient, and this works. The people that you know, and tragically, I know people who have died from drugs and or alcohol. My best friend from high school died at 38. I have friends whose children died before I discovered this. And the purpose of this show is to let everyone understand that there is an additional tool and skill that allows people to motivate and inspire their loved ones to get clean and sober and stay clean and sober. So if this is something for you, you know that I offer a free one-hour telephone session, so please take the opportunity to understand about this and see if these are tools that would work for your loved one. And unfortunately, you've got to do all the work. So that's the secret about this, all right? So let's see. Let's start with, you know, what was the biggest motivation that you had to begin to learn how to transform Bowie's life?
Well, thanks, Susan. I'm here as a great fan of yours, swearing my fealty. And I realized that if I did not learn how to be a different person, how to listen, think, talk, act, and be differently than I was as his dad, that the chances were really good, having gotten him from San Francisco to Santa Barbara, that if I pissed him off, he'd get on a bus, he would go back, and the chances are that I might never see him again. So it was the gift of desperation on my part that had me willing to say, I'll do anything I can.
You know, I still don't understand why we human beings have to feel desperate in order to make changes in our lives, right?
Yeah, we heal at the speed of pain.
Oh, what a lovely expression. Well, I'll be quoting that one, Arno. So when you hear me say this again, I'll say, as Arno says. It's an interesting question then. So what was the best gift of learning these skills of the heart space system for you, do you think? And what was the best gift for Bowie, I assume, was that he had got his life back.
Well, I'll take it in reverse. The best gift for Bowie was that he finally had a dad who listened to him. I learned self-empathy and empathy so that when he spoke, I just listened. I wasn't thinking about what I was going to say. I didn't comment on it. I didn't make it about me. I was able to really narrow cast what my job was. Mm. And my job was just to listen. And the greatest gift for me is that I've been able to be a student of this way of being, and I practice it. I do not lie. I have practiced it every day since. I've practiced it today at work. So the gift is that I've had a life-changing experience in how to communicate.
And of course, the blessing for all of us who know Arno is that now, when we need empathy, because every human does need empathy at some point, then, you know, just as you can say to me, Susan, I need 5 minutes of empathy, and then you tell me why, in the same way, everybody who knows Arno has that same gift with Arno. You can just say, hey, could you give me 5 minutes of empathy? It's been really rough. Because, yes, it's wonderful to have self-empathy skills, know how to give it to ourselves, but it's even more delicious when you can receive it from a friend.
Well, and it's also wonderful to be in a situation when you've had a little experience with this, when you can say to the person you're in conversation with, how can I be supportive? Do you want me to listen? Do you want me to give you empathy? Do you want advice? Do you want input? And these are things I never said before. I just went right into, here's my 2 bits worth. And
it was let me tell you what
way,
to do.
Way more than that. So, yeah, it's incredible. And to give empathy is a great gift, and to be in this process of communicating the way it is enabled me to be the best kind of teacher that I could ever be. You know, I am able to show you how I am and how I act and how I think,
yes,
rather than giving you a big pontification about what I think is right or some sort of a philosophical approach. You know, walk in the talk is a big deal. Yeah. And I learned a lot of that from you.
Yeah. And as you hear later, Arno has a completely different life as a result of all these skills and all the work he's done. He has a different life. But I think everybody wants to hear a little bit of the story because, you know, when I met you, how many years ago was it now?
Almost 10.
Incredible. So here 10 years ago, and he describes his son as being a homeless person who lives on the streets in San Francisco. And then just tell us the abbreviated version, because it's just irresistible.
Well, I had been in a long marriage, and the marriage ended, and everybody was kind of blown apart. We were the picture book couple. And Bowie had the least amount of traction. He was a learning different kid, and school really wasn't a place where he was great and comfortable. So he drifted into the world of street kids and became a street kid. And moved to San Francisco, and the only way his mom and I knew that he was alive was we put money in the bank, and we could see that he took the money out. And after a long time, after almost 4 years, and I would go and visit him every few months to see how he was, he called and said he was ready for a visit, and I went in to visit, and I saw him. And
but
I
then there had been like 10 months when you hadn't seen him
hadn't
heard from him.
We had gone, like I said, the only way we knew about him was if he took money out of the bank. He would go months without calling us.
So, and I think that's really important to understand. These skills worked for Arno after neither he nor his former wife had heard from their son in 10 months, which is such a harrowing experience for any parent who loves his children the way that Arno does. And you shifted the way you thought about him. That was the very first step.
Well, he was willing to come home. I drove him home. And then once he was home, I knew that I had to do something like right now. And we had met before then.
Yeah, of course.
And that was when you started coaching me.
You know, it was interesting. I asked Arno if he would be willing to let go of the labels and judgments that he had about someone who had made the choices that his son had made. Because when you're in the reconciliation phase of any relationship, whether it's marriage, whether it's with children or family members, anything, you've got to have a different perspective of the other person. Because if you show up, or you're even sending out these thoughts of, you're just a homeless drug addict, or you're a dangerous mess, why would anyone want to connect with you? Why would anyone want to be around you? So the easiest thing for me to tell Arno, because I had lived in India, was, you know, if Bowie were in India and he's walking around wandering the streets and he's such a sweet young man, I mean, my goodness, there's nobody sweeter than Bowie, you would think of him as a holy man. He would be wearing orange robes, he would have a begging bowl, he would have a mala, everybody would put food in his bowl, he would bless us. Look how different that experience is.
Well,
and so you did. You got it.
Well, it's we are what we are, the story that we tell, either to other people,
yes,
or the judgments that we make in the story that we say. So
yes,
I could say my kid is a homeless person, and that brings up a whole thing.
Yes.
To say my kid is an American sadhu brings up something else. And
yes,
for me to say, oh, you know, it's all doom and gloom is a whole different story than me saying I am working on a way,
yes,
of doing everything I can to help in transformation, and it's going to turn out great.
Now, let's talk about empathy, which was the number one skill, because we want to spend enough time on that today so that people really understand how you did it. So the first step was that Arno had to be able to bring himself back to peace. He is a very determined guy. He's a very focused guy. But anybody can become swamped with negative emotions in this scenario. I'm sure you'd agree. So I taught you self-empathy. So would you give us a demo of how you were able to bring yourself back?
Just want to say I will, but as you talk about I'm determined and I'm this, I'm also an incredibly emotional person. So my emotions would take me out of the game. So as I was getting ready to have conversations with him, or he was in and he was out, I'd say, oh, when I think about having a discussion with Bowie and the fact that he may not listen to me, I'm scared that he's going to walk out and leave me. When I think about interacting...
Because I need him to stay.
Because I need him to stay. When,
yeah,
I think about interacting with him, I feel weak that my ability to respond and motivate him aren't going to happen. My need for self-respect goes along with me being frightened. I would say I feel hopeless.
Yes.
That I'm ever going to be able to make any change and that he's going to change.
Yeah.
So it was these kinds
of emotions. And because you need him to in order for him to survive.
These kinds
it's
of emotions. I would feel confused,
yeah,
because I wouldn't know what tactic to be, what face to put on.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm,
these were all the emotions. And,
mm-hmm,
and what you taught me was in order for me to be able to give empathy to someone else,
mm-hmm,
I had to bring myself to as much peace as I could, because you can't fake empathy. If I'm saying empathic things,
mm-hmm,
but I'm just kind of going something else, if my,
mm-hmm,
vibe is something else,
mm-hmm,
he's going to know. So self-empathy is an incredible tool. And when a person looks at, when I look at the things that I might be dealing with in a day, situations that I'm going to be in, when I can think about that and say to myself, yes, this might be coming up and I'm going to be scared, I'm not going to get this client or not influence this person to do this or that, And admit that,
mm-hmm,
and give myself those big cleansing breaths afterwards, then when the time comes for me to interact, I'm there, and I'm there for them.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, the question one would ask is, what was the hardest part? I would guess it was catching yourself. Because for me, when I have challenging situations, to catch myself and not do the same old thing and remember to give myself self-empathy. So yes, would you say
yes,
that?
Yes, yes. You know, I knew what I was feeling, so at least I wasn't unconscious, mm-hmm. and I could say, "Ooh, I'm starting to feel this way. I better stop, because if not, I'll get myself over the edge with worry." And mm-hmm. and with Bowie, what really helped was it was a life and death situation for me.
Yes,
precisely. That was extra.
That was the good
that
news.
That was extra motivation that I had. I couldn't indulge in my own mental games that I had done my whole life.
Ah, that's exactly what I. That's the exact perfect segue into why this is such a miraculous story with such a beautiful happy ending. It's not unique because I've worked with a number of clients with situations that were almost as challenging, and in every case, the person who was addicted is still clean and sober after so many years. So whether it was a heroin addiction or a gambling addiction or alcoholism or sex addiction, et cetera, you know, this works. But the key to understand is if I am needing to turn myself around to motivate and inspire the person over there, then I have to understand the way my brain is wired. What you've just described, and Arno so amply describes, that he's a very emotional person who at different times in his life would drift into negative emotion. Mm. And that's the lower right brain, which automatically will either express contempt or it will be trapped in feeling sad or angry or frightened, etc. Now, Bowie has a different primary thinking style. He's more of an upper right brain guy. And upper right brain people, which is where so much of addiction lives in that population, they'll withdraw to try to get peace. And what is a more perfect example of withdrawing than being stoned, being on drugs, right? I mean, it's the ultimate. Or just going away. You know, if somebody has a gambling addiction, the fact that you think the person's going to be at your house when you come home if you're married, and the person actually is in Las Vegas. You know, that's another great example of somebody withdrawing to try to get peace, you know? If it's someone who's very upper left brain, they tend to be functioning addicts, if they are addicts, because they're logical, you know, they can analyze and they know if they go this far in that direction, it's going to be dangerous. But you can get a lot of rage. That's where rageaholics live. And what's worse about an upper left brain rageaholic is they're logical about it. So, you know, it can be quite difficult for you to counter even with empathy. And finally, just so you have all four, the lower left brain person will explain and defend. Now, if you understand these behaviors and you're dealing with a loved one with an addiction, the reason that you want to send me an email and let me send you the map is because if you understand the way your loved one thinks, you'll be able to understand what empathy words to use. And that makes a key thing. So in the case with Arno giving empathy to his son, which we're going to demonstrate in a few minutes, he already knew this. He knew the way the brain was wired. He knew the way his own brain is wired. He knows the way his son's brain is wired. He was able to give empathy words that he pre-selected that were most likely going to have a positive response over there in Bowie rather than a negative response.
Well, you know, part of the process was to take myself out of the equation. There are three parts of motivating someone to make a change. You, the person, and whatever you want to call it, higher power, spirit, God. And my tendency was to make it about me. Well, once I took me out of the equation, it was a lot easier. And then when you begin listening and giving self-empathy and getting empathy, you can tell when you're talking to someone if they have a listening or not.
Yes.
And if they're not open for listening, it doesn't matter what your message is. And that used to not stop me.
Yes.
But it did when I was working on learning it, that sometimes all you can do is say, yes, I can imagine what it's like for you to be worried that you're never going to be able to get sober or whatever. And these are all, it sounds really simple, or it sounds complicated, but it's really simple. All of a sudden you just make it about the other person.
Yes.
And I learned that and working in this process.
Brilliantly.
And it helped.
I mean, it's brilliant because it's the only way that someone is going to really listen to you is if you first listen to them. And the only way that you're going to get someone's attention who's in the kind of pain that an addict is in, because nobody grows up wanting to become a crystal meth addict or a heroin addict or an alcoholic. Nobody does. The only reason people adopt these behaviors is absolute desperation, pervasive hopelessness that they can ever have the life they really want. So now, normally in this tough love scenario, which, you know, according to Dr. Frank Zizzo, is no love at all, and you and I agree on that, normally the first thing that you're told to do is throw the addict out. Now, the problem with that scenario is tenfold. You love your child or your spouse, you don't want them to die. You love them, you don't want them to be taken to prison, because people actually die as a result of prison. People get HIV as a result of prison. It is a dangerous strategy, and it is not the only strategy that works, as we're describing to you today. So what courage to bring Bowie back into your home, and of course you hopefully remember to lock up your money and lock up your jewelry and all that, but talk about it.
Well, there are particularities in our situation, because I know my son really well, that I knew that being in jail wasn't going to be an environment where he was going to prosper and he was going to heal. And
I've done enough workshops in jail that I've never seen a person who's benefited from being in jail. They just tend to meet other people in jail who have more skills to use out on the street to do illegal things when they get out. It's a very dangerous option, you know?
It seemed to me that the best thing that I could do, coming from a place where maybe he thought I had never listened to him before, or I had never really put myself in his shoes before, or I'd never done anything except then give my opinion on what he should be doing, that if I could do that first, that was all I had to worry about, to get to the point where he was listening to me. I mean, we all crave being heard. And in this fast-paced world of ours, and emails and texts and impersonality, to begin to give someone that is enough. He wasn't going to do anything until he understood that I was doing everything in my power to understand him, to not judge him.
Yeah.
And that's how I started. And you were my coach, so you certainly didn't believe in tough love. And for those people that said, put him in jail or he's got to hit bottom, I just thought that I wasn't willing to do that. I wanted to find other ways to hope that I could be in a particular mode with him, that it would help to open up the path for the light to go on for him, for him to make the decision. Because if you're an addict and you're putting all that energy into drinking or drugging, that means you've got a lot of willpower, and that you can, whatever you set your mind you can probably make happen. I mean, Bowie's story was that when he finally decided that what he was going to do was he was going to spend as much time trying to get sober and clean as he did trying to score drugs.
Yes.
And he did.
It's extraordinary. And I know I've heard him say that he was going to put as much energy into getting himself healthy as he did in being so fascinated by going to the gym and working out, because he always described himself as a gym rat. So he loved taking care of himself, and you just were able to reconnect him to that on that day when he finally agreed to go into treatment. So tell us a little bit about that. That's amazing.
Well, I think that there are, if you look at life as kind of a maze, and there are all these blocks in the way, roadblocks.
It feels that way.
Roadblocks.
Sometimes.
You know, when you love someone and you want them to change, when you've got a family member who's addicted, you're a roadblock. I was a roadblock. So if I could do that.
Yes.
And then he's getting messages from the outside world. I'm not the only one. And you know, if you are addicted, you know something is not right. There's no one suffering more than you. There's no one who wants more than you to get clean and sober. And I was a player. You were behind me. We were a team.
Yes.
There were other forces at work. Yeah. And I think he just finally decided that he was going to try something else because he knew what he was doing wasn't working. Mm-hmm. And the only way to keep going, you know, was to try something different. Yeah. And the light went on. I mean, he got a little help from the judicial system.
Yes, that's true. There are always situations. But still, what's interesting about it is because, tragically, I've spoken to people who decide they don't want to do what Arno learned how to do. And one would think that when X, Y, or Z happens to their loved one, that would be the motivation either for the parent, the spouse, or the addict, and yet not always. So what's fascinating is that the uniqueness was the way you interacted with Bowie, because that's what I've seen that really works.
Well, there's security in life. And a lot of times the security in life is negative security. Mm. We say particular things, we interact with particular people, we get certain results, and to change that, to change a comfort level is risky. And sometimes you say, I'd rather suffer than try to do something to stop the suffering. And I was motivated in a way for me around what was going on with my son to stop suffering. And he was too. And that's what it takes.
And you know, what's very interesting about this scenario is that in this particular case, Arno was allowed to stay connected to his son while his son was in detox and rehab, which was a great blessing because Arno had these skills. Remember that the reason that a lot of these facilities don't let the family members have any kind of a connection is because they know that the family member was in the house when the problem was created. So be very clear why facilities make that ruling. But Arno is a very unique dad with a very unique set of skills and a very unique heart. And the place that Bowie went to, Arno was able to stay connected. But remember, if Arno had twisted his arm, threatened him, did an intervention to get him there in the old way. And remember, you guys know that my former client was the executive producer of Intervention. So we know the statistics of people entering on their own free will, even with an intervention very low, 50%. We know that the stats of people staying the whole 30 days or 60 days, very low, 50%. So tell us about how you supported him to stay there, please.
I'm lucky because Bowie went to CRC in Santa Barbara, and they allow families to interact. They have a family meeting even once a week, and you could come and visit. Mm-hmm. And the big skill that you taught me was empathy. We keep coming back to it. Mm-hmm. You just told me when we were in the process of coaching and getting him to that point, I mean, we went from August until December when he finally decided. Mm-hmm. And you just said, empathy, 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 empathy. And once he got into rehab and once, you know, my job was the same. Mm-hmm. If before I could give him empathy for what he was experiencing as an addict trying to make a decision to get clean, I could now give him empathy for being somebody in recovery, going through all of the changes that you go through in recovery, thinking that you can't do it, wanting to walk out, thinking that it's, you know, that it's crazy and you're under all these rules and you know, wondering, having cravings, whatever might be going on. Mm-hmm. It's a simple job for supporting loving people, and that job is give yourself empathy so that you're there for him or her, and then empathy. Easy. That's what I did.
And you know, it's very interesting because this happened in Santa Barbara and because I'm such a good friend of Arno's, I was able to go to one of those meetings. And it was really amazing to see the look on Arno's face, which was just pure love, and to see the look on my face, which I can only imagine was just joy and peace, and then looking around at the other family members who were up in their head and they were suffering and struggling, you know. It was just really amazing because you could see why this works. I mean, you could really see why this works. Now, the question is, you don't have Bowie as a young child in your life right now, but now you could look back and you could see the key identifiers when he was having challenges in school or having challenges with other kids. You know, as Marshall Rosenberg says, and he's the founder of nonviolent communication, we can mourn that in the past we didn't have the tools and skills that we wish we had and that we needed. We can mourn it, but we can also celebrate that right now we do have these tools and skills so we can make a difference. We can't make a difference for Bowie as a young boy because he's not a young boy anymore, but we're making all the difference that's needed and that we can with him as an adult. But describe a little bit what you now know as you look back.
Well, it's a beautiful and true thing that you said about Marshall. And when Bowie was growing up, the one skill that I didn't have was to give him empathy. I was impatient, I was emotional, and I just ended up, if it was problems with doing school or this, that, or the other thing, mm-hmm. his mom and I just did it so that we didn't have to hassle with him. Mm-hmm. And the great thing is that I now have the great pleasure of living with a 13-year-old who's a great kid, and I get to give him empathy. And in that process, model the kind of behavior as an adult who can listen to somebody and maybe not give an opinion unless you're asked. And maybe even if you're asked, not give an opinion. But it just comes back to now it's incredible because that's what we do. And I have friends that have kids that are in high school and stuff and stuff. And to begin to have these kinds of conversations with people that you love. It doesn't have to be your children. It can be your loved ones. It can be your friends. It can be your colleagues. Yeah. To have this kind of communication is so radical when you start off and you realize that part of the skills that you taught me as you get into empathetic communication is you become like a detective. Well, you're saying this, but you know, I really want to know what you're feeling and needing. Mm-hmm. So that if I'm having a conversation with you and your first response is kind of, I don't know, or whatever it is, I want to ask another question to get you down lower. Yeah. And it's like in the mediation work that we've done together. That's right. All of a sudden you realize what the issue is really up, and it makes a huge difference. So I have this opportunity now. By practicing empathy, practicing really active listening to the point where, and you know, the wheels are turning, but it's not about what I'm going to say next. It's about what can I do to get the person that I'm with to understand what's really going on.
Yes, exactly.
It's great. It makes me yearn to have those opportunities with people.
And you know, I just was working and doing some mediation work for one of the biggest rock stars in the world. And an avowed former addict. And I was able to stay in the room because of empathy. Empathy that I gave to him and to his partner allowed me to be allowed to stay in the room. But empathy for myself allowed me to stay sane and peaceful and calm, you know, being in the room. And these are actually people who are no longer using, but still the pain of having been severely addicted to things, to, you know, drugs, alcohol, etc., does have a very profound effect on somebody's ability to communicate and be peaceful. So these skills go way beyond, you know, anything
else. I remember in working with you professionally that you were the only person I knew who could stop and give yourself empathy like that when somebody was in your face. And I said, I'm never going to be able to do that. And I can do it from time to time now. And how wonderful to, like, not only not get, but to not do that, because you get a completely different outcome. And that's why I say there are two things that I practice every day. You taught me and the 12 steps.
Beautiful. And now, so let me ask you about the power of combining the heart space system with prayer, meditation. Now, you talked about thought replacement, and thought replacement is really the turnaround of the four questions of inquiry. Mm-hmm. Whatever way you do it, you may have a different system. But talk about how that allowed you to be present with Bowie.
Well, our minds are operating at at the speed of light. Mm-hmm. And there is no way in the world that I was going to totally be focused all the time mm-hmm. on giving him empathy and doing that. My mind would start to drift. Well, that's when prayer and meditation and being quiet came in. That's where that's when the idea of being able to just see a different result. It's not only telling a different story
yes.
and seeing people differently, yes. but it's like, I'm going to say there's a different result. And this gets into the work, you know, the coaching yes. work that we did when you yeah. have goals and you realize them. But, you know, we are what we think. Our thoughts become deals. So I was a negative, glass empty, pessimistic guy, convinced I could never change, convinced I could never change.
You have to understand, this is the after photo.
And I'm changing.
Yeah,
I'm changing. Yeah, so yeah. That's why prayer and meditation, you know, when you're worried and you're scared and the self-empathy doesn't work, then you just think about
Do
God.
More.
Think about God. Think about something that you like. Think about things that make you happy. And I know that I spent maybe 5 minutes in a day in the old days thinking in that direction, thinking that way. Mm. And I now do more than that. And it's made such a difference in my life. You know, I had a health crisis last year. And instead of thinking it was going to be the end for me in a way that a doctor said it might be the
yes.
end for me, I was told self-healing.
Yes.
Well, why not apply self-healing yes. to everything that we're doing, most especially in this situation with Bowie and the skills that I was presented with in 2004, I'm getting a little better at using them. So thank you.
You're so welcome, my poster child.
Not the poster child for anything, believe me, but thank you.
Now, I know that the most important gift that we can give the people who watch this show is having you demonstrate self-empathy as you were facing the need to communicate with your son, the need to motivate your son, the need to inspire your son. So that's going to be the first thing, to ask you to demonstrate self-empathy. And I'll just first describe that Arno's going to remember, because we're talking about something in the past, that a time when he needed desperately to motivate his son to get clean and sober. Arno first would be looking to see what Arno's feeling is, which is fear, anger, or sadness, to make it fast. And we feel frightened, angry, or sad when one or more of our needs are not met. So Arno may be, in this demonstration, feeling scared because he needs his son to be safe. Then you'll see him take a deep yogic breath. He may feel frustrated because he needs to be heard. He needs his son to listen. And again, he'll take a breath. He may feel angry because his need for privacy isn't met. His son is at home, and 1,000 other feelings and needs, whatever they may be. But remember, it's a feeling that you identify within yourself, a negative feeling, frightened, angry, or sad, a need you identify within yourself, which is, that's a positive word. Need is a positive word. Because that need is not met at the moment, you have these negative feelings. You take a deep yogic breath. That's one round of self-empathy. And then you continue until you feel peaceful. So Arno's going to do it for, I don't know, a minute, 2 minutes, as he wishes.
When in the last stages of Bowie living with me, he would be home until he went out and was stoned for a week and then come back. Mm-hmm. So in those periods of time when he was back, mm-hmm. and he would just mostly sleep, mm-hmm. I would feel angry that he, you know, was abusing me, and my need for peace would never be met with him doing this. Mm-hmm. And I would feel scared that he would die, and my need for love would be gone. I would feel hopeless that he would ever get it right. And my need for support in the universe would not be met. I would feel confused about what I was supposed to do. And my need for self-respect would be shot. I would feel weak and useless because my need to be his dad and be the strength was not met. I would feel scared that he would do something that would cause him to be put in jail and the rest of it for long periods of time. And my need for peace again would not be met. So these are the kinds of things that I could do. And you know, for people who interact with you, you gave me this list of feelings and needs. I've still got them. I still carry them around. And in those days, what I had to do was look at them. And I just kind of go down them like a menu. Oh, I'm feeling, And because my need
hopeless.
And I would do that sometimes for 5 minutes or 10 minutes.
Yeah,
and that's beautiful. Until I got good at making it up,
beautiful.
That's what I did.
Beautiful. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And so it's a 3-page list, and send me an email, and you'll see the email address on the screen, and I will be thrilled to send you both the exercise and also the 3 pages of the feelings and needs. Because in the beginning, you may know these words, but you don't have these vocabulary words ready at hand. And so you have to actually sit down, write down your feelings and needs rounds, 6, 10 of them. Mm-hmm. You have to, you know, carry them in your handbag, stick them in your, you know, pants pocket, stick them on your bathroom mirror. I just got an email from a client today who works for a very, very big Hollywood person, major, major Hollywood person. So she sends me a photo, and the photo has her list next to her computer screen at her office, and I was concerned about her need for privacy because this big, you know, celebrity walks by all the time. It's, you know, his office. She said, no, I put it in a really small font. He really can't read it that small. So it's great. I mean, as long as she's reminded every single day, all day long, self-empathy, and she's in the process of making some transformations in her own life, which is harder. It's easier if you've got a dad or a loved one we'll do this for you.
Well, it's really a beautiful thing. There's a great power in journaling. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did.
Yes.
I I would write it down first.
Yes.
I would just write it down.
Yes.
And then there were times when I would say it.
Yes.
Either way,
yes.
It's a practice because this is all new.
Yes. And what's huge about what Arno said is if you do journaling in the old way, what you're doing is you're writing your complaints and you're making your complaints more real. You're focusing on your complaints, and we can guarantee you that you are actually generating more to complain about.
Well, and
however, if you're doing self-empathy, the needs words are all positive.
The greatest thing about practicing empathy and self-empathy, practicing self-empathy, is that first time you do it and when you're done, you felt better. You felt better without calling somebody, without going to see your psychologist.
Yes.
You felt better because you did it yourself.
It's a miracle, and it works, and it may take you a little practice. It may take you 10, 12 times to do it to really get a benefit, but if you're using the correct words, the words that really resonate with you, it's a miracle. Now, the tricky part then was, let's do a role play. I'll be Bowie. I'll do the easy role, and if you would give me empathy, and let's say that your job is, because the hardest part is motivating somebody who has an addiction into detox and rehab. That's the hardest. So I think if we do that demonstration.
So Bowie, I can imagine that when you think about getting off the streets and making a commitment to be clean and sober somewhere, that it just scares the hell out of you.
I'm fine, Dad.
Well, I hear you say that you're fine. And I can imagine that you want a life when everything is all right, and that you want me to feel positively about how you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, just, I'm fine, Dad, you know?
Well, I can imagine that you think you're feeling fine, and I'm wondering if maybe you feel that talking about your fears might create a weakness in you.
So he really got me just then, just so you know. I'm not going to stop the role play yet, but he really got me because he really understood what my feelings and my unmet needs were. Now, because we want to show you that it's not always going to be that quick, well, you know, I mean, I'm having fun.
I can imagine that you're having fun. I guess that you're having fun. And yet, sometimes if I looked at your face wouldn't be telling me that. So is there other ways that you can have fun? Are you really having fun?
Yeah, and because he's not trying to push me into doing anything, I don't have the kind of fear about admitting it that I would have if this is the old scenario where, you know, if you keep doing this, da-da-da is going to happen, or, you know, if you don't stop doing this, da-da-da is going to happen, right? Because that's the traditional thing that you hear. And so just by continuing to connect with me, you know, then I would feel, you know, it was safe to at least say, well, you know, what are you suggesting, Dad? And you open the conversation.
And on my end, mm-hmm. on mm-hmm. my end, it's just asking questions. It's just asking questions to get you to talk. Because mm-hmm. eventually the light might go on inside of you mm-hmm. as to what's really going on.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are times when the person who has an addiction is going to be much more difficult and much less passive. You know, because this was a demonstration of somebody who's, you know, really he's been on crystal meth, he's been sleeping, he's exhausted. He's a sweet, sweet person anyway. He's a lovely, lovely young man, so he's not a fighter. But now, I'm not going to fight with you because it's not, you know, there's no point to it. But what if somebody says, oh, you know, you've been telling me to do this for years, Dad. It just won't work for me.
Well, I can imagine, I hear you. I hear you saying that I sound like a broken record to you. And I just want you to know that I am committed to do whatever it takes for me to be supportive for you and help in the process, support you in the process. And it may seem strange when I use these empathy words, you know I'm doing it, and it sounds weird, but I just want you to know I love you, and I'm not going to stop. I am not going to stop, no matter how weird it sounds to you, and no matter how difficult it is. And I understand that I might sound like somebody that's been brainwashed.
Which is so powerful. Instead of pretending or getting annoyed at your son or explaining yourself, you know, which are none of those behaviors ever work. And so what's key here is, again, the commitment. The commitment, whether it's spoken or unspoken, the commitment is everything. Because this is a young man who had lost his life. Whether he was still alive or not alive is a very fine line, because someone who was living the way he was living had lost the possibility of a joyous and satisfying life.
Well, I think that I was scared and I was frustrated, and it would have been really easy for me to give up. And if there's any message that I can say to families that are out there dealing with this, it's just that it's possible. It's possible to do things that might seem unheard of. And it doesn't require much. It
yeah.
requires the work that you do with your loved one in that two-step, the old mm-hmm. self-empathy and empathy, mm-hmm. self-empathy and empathy. Mm-hmm. And then when you're not in that process, mm-hmm. Prayer, meditation, positive thinking, you know, other outreach, families in addiction mm-hmm. can find great mm-hmm. solace in Al-Anon,
absolutely.
In psychology, in
yes.
all sorts of things.
Yes.
But the heart space work is like it's something anyone can do mm-hmm. with effort mm-hmm. at home. Mm-hmm. And I think earlier you talked about, you know, the gift is that I have this with me forever. If you're working and for some reason your loved one doesn't get sober now, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. if for no other reason than you are going to get skills and a way of thinking and acting and being and doing with everyone that you come into contact with. Mm-hmm. What a gift. Mm-hmm. What a gift for you. I use it every day. I use it in the clients that I meet with. I use it with my friends.
Yeah, because the clients who, you know, he's an immigration attorney. So the clients that you have feel scared because they have a need for inclusion in the United States. They feel angry or frustrated because they have a need for safety and support, right? So you're finding, whether you're saying these words out loud or not, I'm sure this is like an everyday thing.
Well, after I've coached from you, I mean, the normal thing is you say four sentences, I'm a lawyer, I'm already going to start giving you ways to do it. But when I began stopping doing that first, mm-hmm. and just saying, all I had to say was a sentence, I can imagine how scared you must be at looking at a piece of paper that has legal consequences that you don't even understand. Mm-hmm. Just to say that, mm-hmm. makes such a difference. And that can be in any interaction we have with people, any interaction.
And, you know, what people find very surprising about this system is that I do not work with the addict.
Exactly.
Because that's not the point. The 12-step program is remarkable and it works. Detox and rehab are remarkable. And if you go to a place that has great results, Passages and some of the others, they work. The one that Arno described in Santa Barbara worked. What is key here is this idea of one committed family member. And what is key to the understanding of the one committed family member system is that it isn't easy for you guys. It doesn't become easy until you've mastered a skill. It's not easy to play tennis until you're a good tennis player. It isn't easy to swim laps and laps until you know how to swim. So in order for this to be possible for you, you have to be willing to learn. And in order for you to be willing to learn, you have to have one or more reasons that you have a huge commitment to your loved one's survival and well-being, or you don't want to spend $30,000 on rehab and have to do it two or three times. Whatever the motivation, I don't care. It's just a question of understanding that you have to be willing to learn new tools and skills.
The gift of desperation and life and death situation, which happens for everybody in a family that's dealing with some kind of addiction, is all the motivation that you need. And as I changed how I was, without saying, look at me, I'm changing, mm-hmm. everyone noticed. Mm-hmm. And we shifted the dynamic, we shifted the paradigm. Mm-hmm. And that is a miraculous thing, that the way a family is interacted could be changed. And yes, it only takes you.
Now, it's so interesting. One of the clients that I worked with not too long ago has a daughter who is a heroin addict. And, you know, again, like Arno, you would never believe that these families were dealing with this. And that's, I think, a very important thing to realize, that in today's world, an attorney can have a child who is going through these kind of challenges. Or, you know, people who are professionals, people who have successful careers, have lovely homes, have college educations, people that you know, people all around you. Addiction is everywhere. And, you know, if you live in Santa Barbara, the number of addicts in our town is frightening, because the number of addicts who are still using is so frightening. And this is something that, you know, that I have such a commitment to, because it's not necessary anymore. There are so many tools and skills that exist, and I offer a free one-hour session. So there's no reason why, if you're facing this, you can't take that next step, whether it's to call me or do something else. It's just a question of taking some action. Now, do you feel too hopeless to try as the family member? That's a big part of it, because the family whose daughter is a heroin addict, I had the mom speak to Arno, and Arno was just as inspiring as he always is, thank goodness. And she got that it was doable. She wasn't sure if she wanted to do it because it seemed like a lot of work. But again, what was the alternative? Her beloved daughter was shooting heroin. So she began to work with me. She began to learn this. And like Arno, there were days where you needed to speak to me every day, even for 5 or 10, 15 minutes. It was all free. It was all included in the program. So did this mom. And amazingly, this young woman, 19-year-old girl, walked herself into detox. Now, the courage that that takes is more courage than I ever want to have.
You know, it does take courage. And you learn in this process that there are things that you can do and there's things that you can't do.
Yes.
You can't make someone else decide to get clean and sober.
Yes.
But you can change the way that you respond and react to the situation. And in that process, you do everything possible. You do everything possible to have a positive result for your loved one. And you do everything possible to transform yourself. And that's the thing. Because you can work on yourself and it appears hopeless. It's not hopeless. I knew what didn't work.
Yes. But you know the key to this? If you have a loved one who has this kind of problem, you cannot forgive yourself at some level. At some level, you are trapped in this self-criticism. This was more beneficial to Arno, in a sense, than it was to Bowie, because Arno made it happen. Bowie is the recipient of this enormous gift, to have been inspired to transform his life. Bowie certainly did the work of getting clean. He certainly does the work every day staying clean. That's enormous. But I'm talking about this other part of it, the behind-the-scenes part. Because what happened to your self-respect as a result is that your self-respect went through the roof.
Well, I played a part. You played a part. His mom played a part. God played a part. CRC played a part.
Yes.
So I wouldn't want to overplay that I got him sober. I mean, the old me would have said, hey, look what I did. And that's
but
not,
you got him but into the facility, but, which nobody else had done, right? That we'll give you credit for.
I think that in the dynamic of it all, the change that I got from working with you made all of it.
Ah, well, thank you. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, everyone, for listening today. So appreciate it.
Thank you, Susan.